This chemistry cassette has been produced and is published by the Educational Techniques Group of the Royal Society of Chemistry. The subject is Solving Inorganic Spectroscopic Problems, and the speaker is Dr. Alan Vincent, who is Principal Lecturer in Chemistry at Kingston Polytechnic. Dr. Vincent.
Before starting to use this tape, you should have by you the workbook of diagrams and notes which goes with it, and also a pencil and paper, so that you can make some notes of your own as we go on. I shall also be asking you to stop the tape in some places to try and continue with the problem, so you'll probably need to make a few notes then as well. The problems to be discussed are structural ones, so if you have access to a kit of molecular models, you may find these helpful in seeing structures in three dimensions. The aim of the tape is to help you become more skilled in solving inorganic structural problems using various spectroscopic techniques. There is very little actual instruction in the spectroscopic methods themselves, only in how to put the information together and solve problems. So I'm assuming that you know something of the principles of nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, infrared spectroscopy, and mass spectrometry. Some of the NMR work involves the nuclei phosphorus 31 and fluorine 19. Don't worry if you've only looked so far at proton spectra. Both of these other nuclei have a spin of a half, so the basic principles are similar to protons, although chemical shifts and splittings are of different magnitudes. When a new chemical compound is made for the first time, chemists almost always try to find its structure. That is, the relative positions of the atoms which make up the molecule. We have a large number of methods at our disposal to do this, and in many cases we gather more than enough data to solve the problem. This means that we can get to the right answer by several different routes, but it always pays to check that all the data fit the answer we reach. It also means that there is no one right way to tackle the problem. We often have to go round and round the data, gradually adding to our knowledge about the compound, until eventually we find a structure which fits all our observations. In this tape, I hope to talk through the solutions to a number of structural problems to show you one way to tackle them. When you become more proficient at tackling this sort of problem, you may use completely different approaches to mine. This is fine, because problem solving is a very personal business, and provided you reach the right answer, the precise method is not too important, provided always that you check that all the information fits your answer. During the talk, there are several occasions when I tell you to stop the tape, either to read through a problem or to try and continue solving the problem yourself. The more you do this, the more you will benefit. Indeed, you will learn more from the tape if you try to solve each problem yourself before listening to the commentary. But you might also sometimes need to rewind part of the tape and listen to something a second time. Well, I think that's covered the preliminaries, so let's start now on one of the problems. I've tried to grade them roughly in order of difficulty, so the first few are quite easy, but they do get a bit harder as we go on. In frame one, we have the first problem. The diagram gives the fluorine-19 NMR spectrum of a compound whose analytical composition is known, but whose structure could be one of two distinct possibilities. Read through the problem, make sure you thoroughly understand it, and stop the tape while you do this. Since we are given the fluorine NMR spectrum, let's look at the difference in the fluorines in the two formulations of the compound. In the first formulation, the double salt, one fluorine is present as the anion in propyl ammonium fluoride, while in the second structure, the six-coordinate complex, all five fluorines are on the same silicon. Now, a free ionic fluorine would be moving about much too rapidly to couple with other fluorine atoms, whereas five on the same silicon might give rise to coupling, provided they're not all structurally equivalent to each other. Bearing this in mind, let's have a look at the observed spectrum. Any NMR spectrum gives us the three items of information shown in frame 2. First, the position of each peak, or set of multiple peaks, depends on the chemical environment of the nuclei producing the signal. Secondly, the area under the peak is proportional to the number of nuclei producing the signal. And thirdly, multiplicity, or splitting of the peaks, tells us how many adjacent nuclei are splitting the signal. With these points in mind, look back at the spectrum in frame 1. Now, nuclei in different chemical environments give a different chemical shift away from the reference compound. So it's clear that in this case, we have fluorine atoms in two different environments. These give the two signals, one at 114 parts per million and one at 121 parts per million from the reference CFCl3. The area under each peak tells us the number of nuclei producing each signal. In this case, there are clearly many more nuclei producing the signal at 114 than producing the signal at 121. But without an integration trace to measure the area, we can't tell exactly the ratio between them. Finally, we can look at the splitting. The signal at 114 parts per million is a doublet. Remember, it's the nuclei coupled to the one causing the signal which cause the splitting. So for this pair of peaks, one set of fluorines causes the signal, the other set causes the splitting. Now, splitting into a doublet is caused by one other nucleus. So the resonance at 114 parts per million is split by one fluorine only, so it is probably caused by the other four. We can confirm this by looking at the other signal at 121 parts per million. If we're right, this should be caused by one fluorine and split by four. Its area is very small, so it could be caused by only one. And it seems to be split into five closely spaced lines, exactly what we'd expect if the splitting was caused by coupling to four equivalent fluorine atoms. Incidentally, it's not always clear how many lines are actually present in a weak multiplet like this. But in this case, it's likely to be an odd number because there is one central line above the others. An even number would give two nearly equal central lines. Having looked in some detail at this spectrum, we can now go back to the two possible structures of the original compound. The very presence of coupling between the fluorines has ruled out the double salt structure. But does our interpretation fit a reasonable structure for the anion in the second formulation? Clearly it does, and frame 3 shows this. A 6-coordinate complex of silicon with one fluorine trans to the phenyl group and the other four cis to it. The trans fluorine gives the weak signal at 121 parts per million, split into five by the cis fluorines. The cis fluorines give the strong signal at 114 parts per million, split into two by the single trans fluorine. I've discussed the first problem in some detail, so I hope you'll be able to tackle the second problem shown in frame 4 with less help. The diagram shows the proton spectrum of GePH5, which consists of two sets of quartets and two sets of triplets. Now, I'll give you one piece of information straight away. Phosphorus 31 has a spin of a half and gives very large coupling constants to protons. So effectively, we might expect the whole proton spectrum to be doubled by phosphorus. Having told you that, think about interpreting a proton spectrum consisting of a quartet and a triplet using the three items of information summarized in frame 2. And then think of a plausible valency formulation of GePH5, and you should be able to arrive straight at the answer. Stop the tape while you do this. In frame 5, I've set out some of the points which we can deduce from this spectrum. The quartet must represent a set of protons split by three neighbours, a set split by three other protons into a quartet. The triplet must represent a set split by two other protons. This is hopeful so far, because a set of three and a set of two gives the five hydrogens in the formula of the compound, so things are looking good. But can we tell anything from the coupling to phosphorus? I've already said that it's so large, it effectively doubles the whole spectrum. But the quartet is split much more by phosphorus than the triplet. Now, the quartet must be caused by two protons, since they're split by three others, and it seems likely that these two are attached directly to phosphorus, since they are split so much more than the others. So we can conclude that the compound has the structure GEH3PH2, shown in the answer section in the back of the workbook. This structure, of course, also agrees with the common valences of 4 and 3 for germanium and phosphorus. If you didn't reach this conclusion yourself, or still can't understand it, look up the answer in the back of the workbook and go through the information in frame 5 again. Stop the tape while you do this. Frame 6 shows the fluorine-19 NMR spectrum of sulfur tetrafluoride. This spectrum changes with temperature, and we'll discuss the reason for this in a moment. But look first at the low-temperature spectrum, taken at minus 98 degrees centigrade. This consists of two equal-area triplets. Again, use the 3 points in frame 2 to see if you can deduce a structure for SF4, and see if your structure agrees with the predictions of the simple electron pair repulsion theory of molecular shape. Stop the tape while you work this out. You should by now realize very quickly that this spectrum is produced by two pairs of fluorine atoms. Each signal is split into three by the two fluorines of the other pair, giving a spectrum consisting of two equal area triplets. If we try to use electron pair repulsion theory to predict the shape of SF4, we get the result shown in frame 7. There are five pairs of electrons in the valency shell of sulfur, six electrons from sulfur itself and one from each fluorine. Five pairs give a trigonal bipyramid, and the lone pair goes in one of the equatorial positions. You can see from the diagram that there are two types of fluorine atom, labelled A and B, and these will give rise to the spectrum we've already seen. Let's think now about what happens when the temperature is raised. At room temperature, the spectrum suggests that all the fluorines are in the same chemical environment, that they're all equivalent. Now, it could be that the shape of the SF4 molecule changes as it warms up, until at room temperature, the shape is a symmetrical one, in which all the fluorines really are structurally equivalent. But the experimental results are also explained if we assume that some sort of rapid exchange process occurs. One way this could happen is shown in frame 8. You may be able to follow this from my commentary and the diagram, but if not, you may find it helpful to build a molecular model. Now, if the two axial fluorines, labelled A, move to the right, towards the space between the two B fluorines, and at the same time the two B fluorines move to the left, we eventually reach a stage shown in the second diagram. The two Bs have moved so far apart that they are now opposite one another and are the axial pair. The two As, on the other hand, have moved closer together and have become the equatorial pair, forming a nearly symmetrical triangle with the lone pair of electrons. So the overall effect of this movement is to change the fluorines labelled A from axial to equatorial, while the B fluorines go from equatorial to axial. Now, if this process happens faster than the timescale of the NMR process, all that the NMR instrument will detect is a set of fluorine nuclei in a chemical environment which is the average of the two. The signal will then be a single sharp line. This is the explanation that's generally accepted to explain the change with temperature. This effect is quite common in inorganic systems, particularly in five-coordinate trigonal bipyramidal systems. And it does demonstrate quite well the need to measure NMR spectra over a range of temperature, if we're to be absolutely confident of the results. Well, I think we've done enough for now on fluorine 19 spectra. Have a look at problem 4 in frame 9. This one uses quite a number of techniques, so study it for a minute or two and turn off the tape while you do so. Well, you're probably thinking that this is a big jump from the simple spectra we've been looking at so far. And so it is, but only because there are so many different bits of information to be used. A problem like this always looks a bit daunting at first, especially if we meet it in an examination room. But it can easily be cut down to size if we set out all the information in pictorial form, so that we can see it all at once, and also see how each piece fits in. I've done this in frame 10, and I hope this makes it look a bit more manageable. In this frame, I've also worked out the molecular weight of FeC7H4O3, and this comes to 192. So now it's just a matter of going round the data, extracting information bit by bit, and gradually building up the final answer. Where you start is a matter of experience and of knowing what information you find most helpful. But in this case, I'm going to start with the mass spectrum. Do you notice anything about the four masses given? Or anything about the mass lost each time? Well, if you do the subtractions, you'll find that 28 mass units are lost between each of the masses quoted. One of the skills of problem solving is to be able to pick out regular patterns like this from a set of data. The lost mass of 28, of course, is carbon monoxide. So it looks as if there are three CO groups still on the iron. And we can reformulate the compound, as shown in frame 11, as C4H4 Fe carbonyl 3. The infrared data serve to confirm this. Both the wave numbers given suggest terminal carbonyl groups. The only information left is the proton spectrum. One line on the edge of the aromatic region of the spectrum. This seems strange at first, since we started with an aliphatic compound, but we'll return to this point later. Let's think first of the consequences of there only being one line. It means that the protons must all be equivalent to each other. If the C4 unit is still present as a ring, the four hydrogens would be equivalent only if there was one on each carbon and the iron atom was on the axis of the ring. There's no other simple way we can make the four hydrogens all equivalent. So now we can suggest the structure shown in the answer section at the back of the workbook. Try and write down a structure yourself before you turn to the back to check, and stop the tape while you do this. Let's look now at the answer to problem 4 and see if it's a reasonable chemical structure. The C4H4 ring is not known as a free compound. It would only have four pi electrons and would have no aromatic stability to counteract any ring strain. But if we transfer two electrons from the metal to the ring now has six pi electrons. That is an aromatic sextet. This would explain the stability of the ring, and also the position of the NMR signal, which is just about in the aromatic region. Finally, we can count up the number of electrons on the metal, because many transition metal organometallics have 18 electrons in the outer shell of the metal. The C4H4 2- ring, being aromatic, is regarded formally as a 6-electron donor. Fe2+, has 6 electrons of its own, and 3 carbonyl groups provide a total of 6, giving us the 18 required. This structure, then, seems to fit all the data, and also satisfies our chemical intuition, always an important factor in problems like this. It is, in fact, the structure accepted for this compound, which was the first cyclobutadiene complex ever to be isolated. Frame 12 gives the next problem. Stop the tape while you read it and try to think out how best to start tackling it. In frame 13, I've put a few hints. First of all, the chemistry. Although we're looking at physical methods, it's always as well to place some reliance on our knowledge of the chemistry of the elements concerned. Cesium fluoride, of course, ionizes to give fluoride ions. Antimony pentafluoride is a powerful fluoride ion acceptor. So it could be that there's some sort of fluoride ion transfer involved. We've got the stoichiometry of the reaction as well. There are 2 moles of SbF5, only 1 of cesium fluoride. And now, having considered the chemistry, we can move on to the other aspects of NMR. The peak positions. How many different types of fluorines do you think are present? The peak areas. How many are there of each type of fluorine? And the splitting. Well, there's not a lot we can get from the splitting in this case. Although there obviously is some splitting there, the extent of it is by no means clear. Well, stop the tape while you consider these things and see what structure you can come up with for this reaction product. The interpretation of this spectrum is shown under problem 5 in the answer section in the back of the workbook. I hope it's fairly clear. It's consistent with the formation of a 2-to-1 adduct between the two reagents. We have one type of fluorine marked A, which forms a bridge between the two antimonies. There are 2 fluorines of type C, which are the terminal ones. And there are 8 of type B. Clearly, there will be quite extensive coupling, and this gives rise to the rather broad and split signals which are shown in the spectrum. Frame 14 gives another problem with several items of information. You remember I said earlier that it's sometimes helpful to draw out a pictorial version of problems like this. Well, have a go at doing your own diagram for this one. Incidentally, when you've done that, it's probably easiest to start the problem by tackling the NMR spectrum. Stop the tape now while you work out a diagram for this one. My pictorial version of this problem is in frame 15. Really, it's only a matter of summarizing and collecting the information. But I hope you didn't have too much trouble with the NMR spectrum. I've put an interpretation of this in frame 16. Clearly, coupling to phosphorus doubles the whole spectrum, as we've already seen. But if we ignore this, there's a triplet and a doublet, suggesting that one fluorine is in one environment, while the other 2 are in a different environment. Thus, the signal for the single fluorine is split into a triplet, and the other 2 give a doublet. Go back now to frame 15, and let's look at compound A. It's monomeric, so it must be 5-coordinate. And many 5-coordinate compounds are trigonal bipyramids. So now it's only a matter of arranging 2 chlorine atoms and 3 fluorines on a trigonal bipyramid so as to make the chlorines equivalent to each other, but one fluorine different from the other 2. It's easy enough to tackle this logically. Look at frame 17. It shows a trigonal bipyramid with the 2 types of position labelled A and B. We've got to make the 2 chlorine atoms equivalent. So they must either both go on A positions or both go on B. If they both go on A, then all the fluorines must go on B, and they're all equivalent. Clearly this is wrong, because it does not agree with the fluorine spectrum. But if we put the 2 chlorines on B positions, then we're left with 2 A's and a B for fluorine. This is in accord with the fluorine NMR spectrum, so it must be the true structure. Now, it's not difficult to do this sort of a logical analysis of the possibilities, and in some cases, it does pay off in terms of the results. In this case, the structure shown in the back of the workbook is the only one which satisfies all the data available about the compound. Incidentally, you might now like to glance back again at the original problem to see just how much careful experimental work was put into solving that one simple structure. Chemistry is such a rich and varied subject that experimentalists have learnt by bitter experience that their work must be really thorough if their conclusions are to be reliable. What now about compound B? It's an isomer of A, but clearly has very different physical properties. Virtually the only thing we can say about it is that it's ionic in polar solvents, and probably in the solid form too. Many formulations are possible, but the most likely one is shown in the answer section. If we put only four large chlorines round one phosphorus, it becomes a cation, while six small fluorines will make the other phosphorus an anion. The data certainly don't prove this structure, but it's the best attempt we can make with the information at our disposal. Well, that concludes side one of the tape. To continue working through the program, you'll need to turn the tape over and play the other side, although you'll probably feel like a break before you go on. This is side two of the tape on solving inorganic spectroscopic problems. If you haven't already worked through side one, you may find some of these problems a bit on the hard side, although they are self-contained and don't rely on anything covered in side one. Frame 18 gives a problem about titanium complexes with four fluorine atoms and two other ligands. Now, we got a lot of help in the last problem simply by thinking logically through the different structures possible for a compound. We can do the same thing here. The complexes may be octahedral. If so, there are only a limited number of possible structures, and some of these may fit some of the spectra given. Well, have a look through the problem and think about it along these lines. You may, of course, find that a molecular model will help. Stop the tape while you do this. Well, now that you've had a chance to study the problem, and maybe even to find the answer, I'll show you how I tackled it. I'll look at the chemistry first. A complex involving a transition metal, four ligand groups of one type, and two of another, could well be a six-coordinate octahedral complex. There are two possible isomers of this type of compound, cis and trans, and these are drawn out in frame 19. Do either of these agree with any of the spectra shown? Well, first of all, the trans isomer has four fluorines equivalent to each other, and would be expected to give the single line spectrum C. In the cis isomer, on the other hand, we have two sets of fluorines, which I've labelled A and B on the diagram. These should give signals at different chemical shifts, and each one should split the other into a triplet. In other words, we should get something like spectrum A from a cis isomer. Have a look now at the ligands which give rise to spectra A and C. Would you expect these to give cis and trans isomers respectively? Well, I'd certainly expect the third ligand to produce a trans isomer. It's very large, and if two of them were cis to each other, there would be a lot of interference between the methyl groups. So we seem to have some correlation here with the size of the groups. But what about spectrum B, the one in the middle, with the singly substituted ligand? Have a think about this one. It's really very obvious, but switch off if you haven't thought of it yet. Well, the spectrum in the middle simply indicates that the middle ligand makes a mixture of cis and trans isomers. We haven't got any quantitative data, but it looks as if there's rather more cis than trans. So it seems as if there's some preference among these compounds for a cis configuration, but that they're forced to become trans if the ligand is really bulky. Let's turn now to problem number 8, shown in frame 20. I'd like to say a word about this one before you read it through. The group of research workers who did the original work were investigating how the reactivity of organic ligands was affected when the compounds were attached to metals like platinum. In other words, does an organic molecule react in the same way in the free state as when it's bound to a metal atom? Clearly, this information is important when considering how metal catalysts work, and this, of course, was why the research was done. I've selected one small part of an enormous amount of experimental work to form the basis of this problem. So with that bit of background introduction, stop the tape and have a look through problem 8. This problem is in two distinct parts. Let's look at the first part and leave the complications about bromine until a bit later. I've summarized the key points in frame 21. The first thing we can see is that the free ligand and both product A and product B have a carbon-carbon double bond stretch at about the usual wave number expected for this vibration. So it seems as if both A and B involve attachment of the ligand without affecting the carbon-carbon double bond. Now, the only other donor atom in the ligand is the arsenic, and the fact that the complex has two isomers, A and B, should tell you something about the structure, especially if you can remember a common shape found in a lot of platinum II complexes. Complex C clearly involves the carbon-carbon double bond, since the infrared spectrum is changed, and it also only has one molecule of the ligand per platinum, while A and B have two. You should now be able to write down the structures of A, B, and C before looking at the answer in the back of the workbook. Switch off while you do this. I hope you managed that without too much trouble. A and B are simply cis and trans isomers of square planar complexes, in which the arsenic of the organic ligand is attached to platinum II. We cannot tell from the data we've got which of the two is which isomer. In complex C, one molecule of the ligand is behaving as a bidentate chelate group and is attached to the platinum via both the arsenic and the olefinic double bond. The decrease in the carbon-carbon stretching frequency is quite characteristic of this type of bonding. If we look at the second half of the problem, there are several items of information which I've summarized in frame 21. Reaction with bromine gives a compound with 8 bromine atoms, but still only 2 arsenics. Now, it's very unlikely indeed that this is 10-coordinate platinum. But there's another clue. The characteristic infrared absorption in the carbon-carbon double bond stretching region has disappeared. What sort of clue do we get from this? Well, of course, if we're reacting a complex containing an organic ligand with bromine, it's not just the metal that might react. The ligand might react as well. This, after all, was the purpose of the whole research project. So it's likely that the bromine has reacted with both the platinum and with the carbon-carbon double bond. See if you can work out a structure for the compound based on these ideas, and stop the tape while you do this. Well, a formulation based on these ideas is shown in the answer section. Here, we've oxidized the platinum to platinum 4, making it 6-coordinate, which again is characteristic of platinum 4. And although we've got no information about the isomers, we can suggest that the compound exists in cis and trans isomeric forms. The new bands at 594 and 572 wave numbers can be accounted for as being carbon-bromine stretches. So again, the formulation shown accounts for all the data and is consistent also with the known chemistry of platinum, that it can be oxidized from square planar 4-coordinate platinum 2 up to octahedral 6-coordinate platinum 4. As I mentioned at the beginning of this problem, it's only one example taken from a very long research paper about the effect of complexing on the reactivity of coordinated organic ligands. It's well worth looking at the original paper as a good example of a piece of thorough and painstaking research. Problem 9 is another long, apparently complex problem, combining chemical and spectroscopic information. Read it through, and then try to summarize the information in diagrammatic form. This might help you to see a way through the whole thing. While you're doing this, you should also convert the analyses given into an empirical formula. Don't forget to check that the analyses actually add up to 100%, and if they don't, have a think about how the balance could be made up. I've put my version of the diagrammatic summary in frame 23, but do one of your own anyway, because it's a useful exercise, and stop the tape while you're working on this. Well, hopefully your summary looks something like the one in frame 23, in which I've also worked out the empirical formula. The analyses quoted did not add up to 100%, but since we started with a carbonyl compound, it seems reasonable to make up the balance with oxygen. There's no other element present in any case, and by assuming this, we get a whole number of oxygens in the empirical formula. Let's look at compound A first. The data do look just a little bit simpler for this one. Well, the preparative method, reaction of an organic chloride with a lithium compound, suggests elimination of LiCl. The product that this would produce is shown in frame 24. Let's have a look at it and see if it fits the data. First of all, the formula is right, so that's a good start. How about the infrared? Well, we've got several absorptions around 3,000 wave numbers where we'd expect to find a CH stretch. Hydrogens attached to double-bonded carbon usually give an absorption above 3,000 wave numbers, while hydrogens attached to single-bonded carbon generally give an absorption below 3,000. Both types of absorption are there in the spectrum, and both types of hydrogen are present in our proposed structure. We've also got four carbonyl bands around 2,000 wave numbers, a carbon-carbon double bond stretch at 1620, and other bands lower down, which are characteristic of a vinyl group. I've given full assignments in the table in frame 25. You might like to stop the tape for a moment while you look at these. Now look at the NMR spectrum. There are two protons of type A, and since these are quite close to the metal, we'd expect them to give a resonance at quite a high field. We'd also expect them to be split into a doublet by proton B. This is entirely consistent with the signal at a shift of 1.8. In the same way, the single proton, which I've labelled B, should be further downfield and should be split by both the A and C protons in quite a complex way. The signal at delta equals 6.2 parts per million is clearly due to this proton. The other signal, centred on delta equals 4.9, must come from the end protons, labelled C. But why is this signal split into a rather unsymmetrical triplet, and not into the doublet which we might expect? Well, this shows the danger of the rather shorthand formula I've given in frame 24. If we draw out the complete structure of the organic group, as I've done in frame 26, we see that the two protons on the end carbon atom are different, and the signal from them is the result of two overlapping doublets, which together give the rather unsymmetrical triplet appearance of the resonance at delta equals 4.9. Well, we seem to have accounted satisfactorily for the structure of A. But just to be absolutely certain, let's do an electron count to see if it complies with the 18-electron rule. We can take it as manganese in the plus 1 state, which has 6 electrons, surrounded by 6 ligands, including the organic group as an anion. Each of these 6 ligands donates an electron pair, giving us 18 electrons in all. So the compound does have the familiar 18-electron structure adopted by many low-valency transition metal complexes. When compound A is heated to 100 degrees centigrade, it loses carbon monoxide and produces B, which has distinctly different infrared and NMR spectra. Let's look first at the infrared. The 1620 wave numbers carbon-carbon double bond stretch has dropped down to 1505. And the band at 2925 wave numbers from the CH2 attached to manganese has gone. These data are consistent with a change in the nature of the organic group to some structure with partial double bonding between all the carbon atoms. The NMR spectrum, too, shows important changes. It is now consistent with two pairs of protons, each split by the other one. If we put all this information together, we come up with a structure like that shown in frame 27 for the C3H5 part of the molecule. The structure has three electrons in its pi system and can act as a three-electron donor to a metal like manganese. If you do the electron count, this gives us our 18 electrons again, because the manganese atom has 7 and each CO donates 2. But let's just confirm that the NMR spectrum does indicate the presence of a pi allyl group. Clearly, the protons shown as A are different from those shown as B, and they will give signals at different chemical shifts. Each will be split by the single proton C, but to different extents. Coupling trans across a double bond is usually larger than coupling between two cis nuclei. So we can probably assign the signal at delta equals 1.7 parts per million to the pair of B protons, and the signal at delta equals 2.7 to the two A protons. The single proton is coupled to both the A's and the B's, giving the complicated signal at delta equals 4.7 parts per million. The final problem is shown in frame 28. Again, it's one of those complex problems where we've got to integrate a lot of information, and I suggest that again you try to summarise it in diagram form. We've also got some analytical data, which should be converted to an empirical formula. But do check, won't you, to see whether or not the analyses add up to 100%. Stop the tape while you read through the problem and work on these preliminaries. In frame 29, I've worked out the empirical formula. The analytical figures did not add up to 100%, so I've again assumed that the balance was oxygen. I've also summarised the data in this frame, and you can see that we've got five items of information that we can use: the way the compound is made, three lots of spectroscopic data, and an approximate molecular weight. Perhaps the easiest one to start with is the mass spectrum, because we notice at once that the highest peak here corresponds to both the empirical formula and the molecular weight measurement. So the empirical formula is very likely indeed to be the molecular formula. Work out the mass loss from 368 to 340, from 340 to 312, and so on, to see if the mass spectrum gives any clue to the individual components of the structure. Stop the tape while you do this. The losses in the mass spectrometer are an immediate help. There are four losses of 28, which is, of course, the mass of carbon monoxide. So it looks as if our compound contains four carbonyl groups on the metal and can be reformulated as shown in frame 30. This formulation is also consistent with the infrared bands given. These are all in the region where terminal carbonyl groups absorb, and a set of four such groups can produce up to four bands, so it's all nice and consistent so far. The remaining problem is how to fit C4F8 onto the iron to be consistent with two items of data: firstly, the fluorine-19 NMR spectrum, and secondly, the existence of a fragment of mass 162 as the most intense ion in the mass spectrum. We might at first be tempted to write down structures like those shown in frame 31. These certainly fit the formula of the compound, but they can be criticised on several counts. Structure 1 is a very symmetrical structure and would certainly give fewer than 4 infrared active CO stretches. In fact, trans tetracarbonyls such as this only give 1 infrared active band in the CO stretching region. Also, this structure would only give 1 fluorine 19 NMR signal. Structure 2 would be expected to give 4 infrared bands, but the fluorine NMR spectrum is wrong. There may admittedly be a slight difference between the two ends of the tetrafluoroethene ligand when it's on the metal, but the two NMR shifts are much further apart than we would expect for structures like these. We can also criticize these structures from a theoretical standpoint, in that they don't obey the 18 electron rule. Now, this is not an infallible guide, but coupled with the spectroscopic evidence, it does lend weight to our rejection of the structures shown in frame 31. Well, having rejected two possibilities, let's look a bit further. What do you make of the mass spectral fragment at 162? It contains no iron. We can be sure of that because it would show characteristic isotope patterns if it did. It seems unlikely that the most intense peak in the spectrum would come about by rearrangement involving oxygen. So it must contain only carbon and fluorine. See if you can find a formula containing C and F only, which has a mass of 162, and stop the tape while you do this. Frame 32 shows the most likely structure of the 162 ion, hexafluorocyclobutene. This suggests that the 4 carbon atoms in the molecule are all joined up. In other words, that the 2 C2 reactants have formed a 4-carbon unit under the conditions of the preparation. Now, if we make a C4F8 chain, as in frame 33, we have a structure which accounts well for the fluorine 19 NMR spectrum. There are 2 types of fluorine atom, A and B, giving our 2 chemical shifts. Each A fluorine is split by the B fluorines, and each B is split by the A's. See now if you can write down a structure for the whole compound, and check your answer with that given in the back of the workbook. Well, that concludes this tape on structure determination problems. I hope it's given you some insight into the way to tackle problems of this type. They certainly can be very tricky when you first meet them. But then, when you actually arrive at a structure which fits all the observed facts, that can be very satisfying indeed.